Everybody good to go?
Good to
go.
Sure.
Good to go.
Welcome, welcome. We are here today with Greg Story on the Hustle Podcast. Greg is a design leader and former partner of Happy Cog. I'm also here with Anthony.
I'm a partner at FunSize.
And I'm Rick Messer. I'm a product designer at FunSize. And like I said, we got Greg here. Hey, Greg, how's it going, man?
Good. Hey, guys.
Awesome.
Thanks for making time to hang out with us this week in the office and join us on the podcast. It's good to have you here.
Sure. It's been fun to be here.
Cool.
So fun. We're having fun now. Well, it's a beautiful day in Austin, Texas. We're just kind of relaxing, kicking back. Thought we would just kind of shoot the breeze with our good friend Greg. Anthony wanted to bring him in, and you guys have some things to talk about.
Yeah, there's been a lot of interesting things happen lately. You know, Greg has been, you know,
like
voice in my ear over the last few months, actually. Greg, you want to give us a little introduction to what you want to talk about today?
Yeah, maybe even a little bit about your background or who you are for those listeners that don't know you, if you don't mind.
No, not at all. Greg Story, I live here in Austin, Texas, neighbor to you fine fellows. I've been working in the web since 1994. I've done web, email, not Flash, but pretty much everything else. Have mostly not only designed but led design teams almost from day one. And up until recently was a partner at Happy Cog. I'd started my own studio in 2005 called Airbag, and in 2009 merged that with Happy Cog and was there up until last October. So now I'm actually talking to some other folks in some companies and thinking through what's next. So, Anthony, you were talking about, you know, things that you and I have been talking about, and I think that's kind of the tips into the future of the design agency, which, as you know, in kind of our circles, has been a hot topic as of late.
Yeah.
with Brian from Zurb, I think it was Brian from Zurb, and Peter, both kind of writing that the design agency or design studio is dead or is dying or changing. And that's been kind of what I've kind of bugged in your ear about is FunSize is definitely right in the middle of that, although I don't think the future is as dire as some people would like to believe.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, for us, you know, when we started this company, we weren't really thinking too much about starting an agency because it really wasn't what our goal was. But
you accidentally started.
We accidentally started an agency, but and we knew a few things pretty well, and that was like agile development. And I think naturally some of the things that we're doing, we kind of fell into being on the plus side of the way things are changing, you know. But I also know that there's probably, we're also part of maybe some of the problems, right? You know, like, you know,
you guys mentioned that, you know, that those articles had come out about the older agencies dead or whatever. What are some of the? Can you guys bullet point that for some of our listeners? Like, what are they saying about that? What are they saying is causing something like that?
Well, and it's not just the authors of those articles in particular. I co-founded the Bureau of Digital Affairs with Greg Hoy, and for the last 2 or 3 years, we've been putting on an event for design studio owners called Owner Camp. Mm-hmm. Just recently, they had Owner Summit here in Austin, which Anthony and I went to. And I think there's a pervasive feeling that in the last year or so, maybe in some cases a little bit longer, companies have just simply started hiring designers, making their own studios inside, mm-hmm. you know, bringing all that talent in-house. And the companies now have the wherewithal not only to they don't even just have the budgets, they know how to do this, mm-hmm. right? So there's a prevailing thought that eventually the work is going to go into decline, you know, so work that agencies like FunSize would do, or studios like FunSize would do, like that's going to start going away because your clients now will be hiring enough designers that they won't need agencies. That's kind of the, am I missing anything?
And the reason for them hiring designers, just from a cost standpoint, makes a lot more sense financially to have somebody on, like one or, you know, a small team and salary, or just the deeper understanding that they get by.
I think it's a deeper understanding because an employee costs a lot more than a consultant. I mean, obviously, depending on what the hourly is or what that breakdown is, but when you bring an employee on and they're full time, you've got benefits. You know, and even things like Social Security tax, that stuff adds up, and those are costs that are typically, you know, not a one-to-one, you know, consultant versus employee match. Mm-hmm. I think employees, companies have the benefit of, they have not just a deeper understanding, but you can also go to an employee and say, hey, wait a second, it's Friday afternoon. You know, you're not leaving yet. I need you to work through the weekend, right? And an employee, typically on a salary, salaried person, there's not going to be an extra cost, right, for the business. So there's something to be said about that. Whereas if you're one of your clients called you guys in about an hour and said, "Hey, I need you to stay," you'd be like, "That's great. Here's what's going to cost you," right? And that's not going to happen in an employee versus consultant situation.
So that's sort of that kind of financial breakdown might be one thing that is fueling this sort of transition with the agencies today.
Well, so I don't know if there's a transition, but companies are definitely hiring more designers. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go to Authentic Jobs, you'll see more larger companies, bigger brands than there were in years past.
I think that's where it is. Like, you know, a lot was popularized by product design and a lot of designers being actually excited about going to work in-house for a company like, you know, Zappos or Amazon. Mm-hmm. So now the track for a designer is you don't have to just be a freelancer or work for a studio. You can work anywhere you want. And it's actually cool to be in-house now, right? It's a viable option. Another thing that I've, you know, been thinking about and I've been reading about and lately is that it's not that these companies won't work with agencies anymore. It's that there seems to be they want to own it. You know, like they don't want to just hire an agency to say, okay, design our website or design our product. Let us know when it's done and we'll release it. They want the ownership of the strategic roadmap.
They want to be more attached to the product and attached to their work.
Well, it's not just that they want to own, or at least be heavily involved in the strategic thinking, you know, throughout the whole project. They also want to develop in-house capabilities to take that work and to extend it, you know, well beyond the engagement. Mm-hmm. So whereas, you know, in airbag days, we would get hired to redesign a website and then get called back about a year or two later. Now you don't hear back from those companies for maybe 3-4 years, you know, and this all is dependent upon, you know, who the client is, what kind of budgets they have, what kind of even need they have to update the websites. But the type of work and how the work is even, you know, offered out there is changing. So you mentioned, Rick, that, you know, there's a cost benefit. We just talked about how there's a benefit for the client with an in-house agency to kind of own the whole process and therefore have an educated staff that they can, you know, extend the site. The third thing is, and I just forgot it.
Well, you have the financial standpoint, then you have the deeper understanding that, but then there's a benefit on the designer side as well too.
Well, so I would say let's get that in a second. The third thing, which I was having a hard time remember, is that companies would usually have, or at least in my experience, used to have larger projects. You know, come to you and say, "Hey, we have a very large, probably take a year or maybe a year and a half, big project with a big budget." You know, lots of stakeholders. And what's changed is now they have that same budget, that same, all those tasks, but they're smart enough now to break it up into small deliverables or small chunks. So instead of getting the large job where you may say, here's a $250,000 job, now it's, well, let's do something together first. Yeah. And that might be like a small discovery, kind of a bunch of tasks there. And that's to make sure the cultures are right, it's the right fit. Then once the fit is right, or, you know, if it is, then they'll say, okay, well, now we have, you know, $100,000 in UX work for you to do. Mm-hmm. And so the entire time, throughout the entire engagement, the client is doing that to keep the agency in check and to make sure that they know, like, this isn't a one-and-done deal. You're going to have to keep fighting for every inch of this project. And that's something I think is relatively new, something that at HappyCog we just started seeing in 2013 and 2014 especially, where you know, even existing clients, clients that we had been working with for 2 years, were now kind of using this new new way to go about dishing out work.
Just piece by piece, kind of.
Yeah. And that's it's difficult. It's not impossible, but it just changes how you have to do a business, and it puts it requires a lot more time on the business owner or the client management side of things, and it definitely keeps you on your toes. Hmm.
Another thing that you know, we're aware of here at Fundsize, similar to what you just mentioned, is that these companies have a lot of work they want to do. Sure, they need to keep the agency in check, but they're also thinking about the budget over a long period of time. So, like,
sure,
that $250,000 spread out over a year versus in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And constant work to, instead of, like, there's a definite end date. We see a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're also kind of playing in a weird space between, you know, when do I hire? Like, a lot of our clients are thinking, when am I going to have internal product designers? What does that mean for my relationship with a vendor? You know, we just heard from one of our clients yesterday that said, yeah, we want to keep working with you, but we also want your help helping us grow an internal team so that we can have the division of labor work out in a certain way where you guys can help us with this kind of big, more powerful stuff, and our internal person can be more rapid change mm-hmm. mode, right?
Yep. Yep. I think that's... If there's a trend to be had here, that's it, right? So does the agency disappear? No. But it means that agencies are going to have to develop you know, that kind of deep thinking, strategic, big picture programs. Mm-hmm. Having clients to update monthly newsletters and you know, make small incremental changes to websites. I don't know how it is in the app world, but... especially in the web world, that's not what you use an agency for, mm-hmm. right? You go find somebody who with some, I would say somewhat minimal training and talent can do all of that work. And
a freelancer, perhaps, or something.
No,
like
I'm
that.
Talking about an internal, somebody who's an internal person to the company.
Oh, okay, yeah. That'd be one of their responsibilities.
And then at that point, you're paying whatever, depending on what region and what mm-hmm. kind of company. You're paying anywhere from $12 an hour to, you know, maybe $80,000 a year. You know, like the UT has jobs available for web designers to do this kind of, you know, day-to-day task level stuff. And mm-hmm. I think that their salaries are something like $18 an hour. You know, it's, so,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you can't even compete with that. So, no. So why bother? So
yeah.
I definitely think that there's, there is a shift that is already in play in terms of what agencies are going to be looked to do. What's not clear to me is what's the profile of the agency where this really kicks in. So if you're a freelancer, if you're a shop of 2 to 3 people, I think you will likely start to see this if you haven't already. See kind of a little bit of a shift in some of this stuff. But it's not until you get into larger team size, larger payrolls, you know, much, much larger company over, I would say, 20 to 25 people, that's when you start seeing the impact of this kind of shift in business.
So do you feel like it's like becoming impossible to maintain like a size like that?
I think the size of companies where that impossible gap used to be between 25 and 50 people. And if you were in the middle of that, you know, that was like quicksand. You either had to get as quickly to 50 as possible
mm-hmm.
Or retreat back to 25 as quickly as possible. Now, mm-hmm. I think that number is more like 15, mm-hmm. you know, to maybe larger. If it's not 15 to 50, it's 15 to maybe even 75. Now, this doesn't apply to everybody. I'm speaking generally based off my experience in running businesses and kind of conversations that I've had during many owner camps. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely a gap in there where if you don't have a lot of work coming in and everybody is just working in that gap of, let's say, 15 to 50, you just start losing money quickly, really quickly.
Interesting.
Oh. Yeah.
Yesterday, you gave a presentation, a keynote presentation to the team, and you were talking about some of the stuff. And one of the things that you mentioned were some numbers about the average size of these agencies are in the mm-hmm. marketplace right now, and in the amount and some of the projected growth.
Growth so of the industry. The web design. Space, just web design as a services industry or vertical, is supposed to be worth about, is doing $21 billion a year annual in revenue. And that's just within the U.S., and that's just web design. That's that does not include apps, like the kind of work that you guys do. So it does $21 billion annually. There are, at this point, roughly about 125,000 companies that are in this industry.
125,000.
So of those 125,000, 75% of those companies are four or less, basically one to four people. Yeah.
That's what was surprising to
So then that. From that other matrix, I think it's something like 93% are 10 or fewer people, right? So if you take a look at that and whatever 93% of 125,000 is, that's the landscape that you're looking at. So you're talking a lot of small shops. So the other interesting thing about that is, of that $21 billion of revenue annual, there's no major player in the space. So if you take, you think the people like Fun Size, Razorfish, RGA, even Publicis Group, you know, these large, big companies, Deloitte Digital, all this, none of those companies make up 5% of the total market, right? So this industry is owned by small shops. It's owned by freelancers. It's owned by shops that are one to four people. Now, here's the weird thing in doing some math and taking a look at the annual growth of this industry. And keep in mind, this is also supposedly just web design. But in 2004 to 2014, you had an enormous amount of revenue. The revenue grew in those 10 years. Mm-hmm. And it grew something like, four times the rate of growth of the agencies, right? Now that we're here in 2014, and if you trend out the next 10 years, those numbers flip. And revenue is going to shrink while the number of agencies is going to outgrow revenue. You know, so you'll have basically, I would say, like probably twice the amount of agencies by, 2024? And your revenue will only grow up go up incrementally. So, you know, like now this is just one report and kind of, I think, the first of its kind. But it does have a lot of data, and it's, if anything, it's at least worthwhile looking at that and kind of seeing where you are, where any agency is in the big picture, and, you know, what might be the future.
And so there, you guys have been this, you know, in ongoing discussions on how do you kind of adapt to that projection. Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at the face of it, it just means that people are going to be doing the same amount of work for less money. Mm. I mean, they will have to, right? So it doesn't mean everybody will have to. But if you say you're doing websites now and you're charging $75 an hour, it's likely that by 2024, that number could be cut in half, right? So,
wow.
Yeah. And I would assume, so the danger here, and why I talked to Anthony, is that app design and kind of what you guys do is, to some degree, just a different different style of work than what's been done in the last 20 years, right? And even though creating apps takes probably a lot more engineering work than creating websites, I would see that segment of the industry, even though it's not part of this report, you know, is going to fall in line with what's happening on the web. And so eventually, hopefully not before we retire, eventually it's just going to get a lot more competitive. The price is going to get driven down. And yeah, welcome to the happy future of digital design.
So how does a company survive? Like, how do they differentiate, you know, in a world where there's 120,000 companies in North America, and within 10 years we're going to be double that?
Maybe we should go into the culinary field or something.
Well, so differentiation can happen in a lot of ways. You know, one is in size and your ability to be agile, not the process, but just literally be agile. Price is always a one way to differentiate yourself, but not the one that you want to use. But I actually do think it is developing, like going into different industry verticals and specializing. And then there's always enterprise, you know, and the enterprise world is horrible. I mean, it looks like 1925 compared to, if you take a look at an enterprise level app and you take a look at a consumer app, it's day and night, mm-hmm. and not in a good way.
Oh yeah,
and you have companies like IBM who are hiring thousands of designers to try to fix their own stuff, you know, make their own applications much better than what they are today, for they themselves to be competitive with the people that, you know, they have to go up against. So, you know, how does an agency differentiate? How do you survive this? How do you prepare for this? And I think it's just anytime you can find a little bit of a niche. You know, it's cliche, but anytime you can learn more about a particular industry or even a subset of that industry, I think that's where you find some early success.
Find a vertical.
Yeah, I don't know if this is true or not, and you could please correct me if I'm wrong.
Sure.
But Natalie and I seem to think that maybe another way is in the experience that the customer has actually working with you.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, you were talking about customer experience. I don't mean that exactly. I just mean, how did they feel about work? You know, like, did they feel like you were, like, over here in left field? Or, like, did they feel like you're a part of your team? Like, did they, you know, I don't know. Like, but it seems like some of the more popular traffic to our site goes to our culture section, not to work or things like that.
Right. I definitely think that that's a place where you can differentiate and where you can be very competitive. So if you live in Kansas City, know anybody who works in Kansas City, if you've driven from the airport to downtown Kansas City, you will have passed an agency called VML. And they're large, and they do a lot of work. But they also go in and just completely destroy any and all goodwill to most of their clients. They continually overpromise and underdeliver. And I know this firsthand, one, because I know some people who live and work in Kansas City and have had to endure the VML relationship. And twice, HappyCog was called in to fix problems that VML had mm-hmm. created. And a lot of it had to do with the way that people were treated, you know, and they just have a horrible, horrible, horrible reputation in that city. And yet they get hired back, right? So somebody will hire someone like HappyCog, have a great experience, but they're so used to having the locals, you know, call and say, hey, let's go get lunch so I can chew you out for charging me three times what you said you were going to charge me for. They tend to get work in that way.
So that's an interesting subtopic that I am curious to ping you about. Like, I remember back in 2006 when I worked at Behavior, a lot of the RFPs would, like, in the top five questions, like, you would always see, like, how far are you from our office?
Yeah, especially New York.
Yeah. Has that changed, you know?
No, well, it depends on the city. So
yeah, isn't it just New York is like
no,
about that?
No, Boston is extremely territorial. In fact, I will never do business in Boston. I won't try to do business in Boston ever again. Many times we have gone to pitch work in Boston. We've won the work only to be told, nope, sorry, we just found out you're not down the street. You know, so the procurement officer or some head honcho who wasn't part of the sales process finds out that we're not in a Boston zip code, and immediately we get canned, right? And New York is the same way, although not, I don't think, as bad. But there are some places that are, Santa Monica has been, I've had that happen in Santa Monica. So I think it depends on the individual and their comfort level in working virtually, right? And there's a lot of people who are still trying to learn what that means and adapt that to not only how they work, but even just being comfortable with it. So I think it's still going to happen, but I can tell you for sure, Boston would not try to do business in Boston ever.
Yeah. Out there on the East Coast, things are still, you can feel it. They're very like face to face shake, you know?
Yeah.
You know, they need that. And I was watching this video that Lullabot created the other day. And one of the big things about their culture is they're distributed.
Yes.
And that's another thing that you and I have been talking about. How do clients feel about distributed teams?
I've never had a problem with that. I think we, you know, especially if you communicate that early on and you're able to show that despite your the distance between people, you have a cohesive team, you know, that not only can you work together, but you also have a company culture together, that does not get in the way. I mean, that's really what you have to communicate is, our geographical diversity is not going to hinder this project in any way. Yeah. And I think that, Airbag started out virtual. We were virtual for a number of years. When I got up to about 10 employees for an entire year, I had about 10, 11 people that were entirely virtual. And, you know, the only thing that really bothered me about that, and our clients didn't care, but it really bothered some of us who had been working together, you know, in the office, is that, you know, when we were remote, I mean, we were in other states, you know, it wasn't just down the road. Mm-hmm. So you didn't get to just go hang out from time to time.
Yeah. And you can't like have the victory together. You know what I mean?
You just have to do it differently, you know? So, but I got to tell you, I mean, I think that you want to talk about differentiation. That's another way to do it. You know, because and being competitive, getting rid of office space, or at least turning that into more of like meeting space, so that you don't have to have a desk for every person. I mean, that is the future. It's just a matter of where you're working and how soon the workplace is going to adapt. But I mean, that's coming.
My first company, 39 Argyle, that I started with Steve, there were five of us, and we were always in different cities. In fact, there was over maybe 2.5 years, I only saw Chris, one of our designers, face-to-face, like maybe twice. We had to be really creative about how are we going to create that company culture, right? Like, so unfortunately, it did involve a lot of Skype calls, you know? But then we just got to a point where we would just leave Skype on, you know, or tools like that would just kind of mimic, like, you know.
Yeah. Even today, there's a lot more tools that allow, you know, so you keep Slack on.
Yep.
Skype.
One Squiggle.
Squiggle. Yeah, that's a cool product.
Meant for that. And in fact, to save like your battery, the way it works is it just takes like a photo like every 30 seconds or something. Mm.
Have you seen that?
No.
It creates like a grid.
Yeah.
Pictures of your remote people, and it takes a photo,
and it's like it fades to black and white, and then if you want to talk to somebody, you just click on them, and then it goes on to video in color. It's kind of cool.
I mean, it's no coincidence that these things are evolving, right? Because they're evolving to meet the demands in the marketplace and to create new ways of doing business that weren't possible even 5 years ago. When we did it in Airbag, we had, you didn't have Skype. You had IM audio and video, and then Skype came later, frankly. We used
Dropbox back then.
We didn't have Dropbox.
Oh man, did you guys ever have to use those like virtual SVNs or whatever?
And FTP and all kinds of weird stuff.
Oh man, those are such a pain.
No, we got started with, I want to say we got started with an IRC chat channel. And then Campfire came out not too long after that. So we were able to have, you know, basically Slack version 0.1. And then we used IM and video and audio capabilities there, and then used SVN for version control. Mm. And that was it, you know. And in terms of company culture, once we got Campfire and you could upload images into Campfire, mm-hmm. you know, back in 2007, you would animated GIFs going on and links to, couldn't do audio, but you could do iTunes, and eventually you could do YouTube. But in terms of like the culture, we would also do things like hop on Xbox. So there was there was a point in time where I got made sure that everybody, I want to say I didn't get everybody Xbox, but I made sure everybody had Xbox and their Xbox Live account. And so about, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, just about the time that the guys in the East Coast were logging off, we'd get into Halo and just beat the crap out of
each
other.
There you go. That's a creative way of keeping it connected.
Well, it also gives you a different way of interacting that's not solely based upon work and sitting in front of computers. I think that's what you get out of having victory parties and mm-hmm. being able to go to happy hour. You're interacting with everybody, but not in front of a computer or doing work.
So, I mean, let's talk about some recent news now. You know, today we heard that TN Lacks closed its doors to join the Facebook team.
Yeah.
So the company itself, or I thought it was, I actually haven't read the whole thing yet. I just heard the headline.
The principals of the company, and they didn't go to a huge amount of detail about this, but basically decided that they no longer wanted to run a design studio is what I got out of it. There's a very long blog post about it, but they no longer wanted to be their own studio. They wanted to go work elsewhere, a place where they felt they could have a bigger impact on the world and make great things. And so they essentially walked away from their studio and shut it down, and they're going to go work for Facebook.
Yeah. And then this is happening all over, you know, a lot of cool shops, you know, 80-20, Adaptive Path,
mm-hmm.
Fjord, like.
Fjord.
Yeah, you know, people think that these companies are being acquired for massive sums of money. My hunch, based off of knowing a couple of stories, you know, of agencies getting acquired and whatnot, is that they're getting something, but you're not talking about instant millionaires here. You're simply talking about design studios and especially the partners, the founders, who are given an opportunity essentially to practice their vocation without having to worry about where's my next paycheck going to come from. And it's interesting. We're starting to see kind of like a burn rate for an agency owner. You know, how much time can you really put in before it's like, all right, I built this. It's great. It's not worth 2 cents, you know, and that's the reality of it is if you don't have a client roster that kind of like an ad agency will be an agency of record. Right. And mm-hmm. so they will have a client list so that if a company comes in behind them, they already see that there's guaranteed revenue coming in through the door. That's why ad agencies are bought and sold, right? For what we do, there's very few of us that actually are a quote agency of record that have a client that we work with that we're on retainer for, mmm-hmm. you know, for long, prolonged periods of time. If we did, that would build value and that'd be something to sell. Otherwise, you've got people and you've got computers.
Yeah.
That's it.
And people have tried that. You know, Schematic for a while was agency of record for Dell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they opened an office in Austin just for Dell. And then what's happening? You know, Dell's taking the work in-house, right?
Yep. Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. So, but I do see this as, I think eventually you just, as you talked about this early on, that you and Natalie started here and kind of grew a business by accident. And as you know from going to Owner Camp, that is not, or I should say that is a really common story. It's the same thing I did with Airbag. I started Airbag, started working with freelancers just to see what it was like to work with people that I thought were pretty cool. In some cases, it was actually the type of work that needed to be done. I couldn't do myself. But then after a while, it's like, okay, I'm just going to bring this person on full time, you know, and then you bring on another and then you bring on another. And then you start to see that, hey, if I can continue to do this, I can get it to about 10 and I can actually have a business that brings in a steady income, and I don't have to worry about being a freelancer and always going shopping out every yeah. 2 weeks, you know, next gig. But after a while, I think that unless it's wildly successful, and maybe even if it is, it just after a while, it's like, all right, enough is enough. You know, you can only grow that business so much before you really start to lose your time, your soul. You know, it takes a lot. A lot of people don't see this, especially even when you work in a studio. It takes a lot to run a small design studio.
Yeah, and you know, there's definitely a lot of, you know, every time you hear about one of these things, there's a lot of, you know, mixed opinions, and then you start hearing from the people that work there, you know, and things like that. I can see both sides of it, you know. One of the good things, right? I mean, you look at a company like Tien Lax, industry leaders in the mobile space and web space for a while, they've created a career path for these guys that, you know, I'm sure they're, you know, wherever they go, they're going to have lots of like good options. And
hey, wait a minute. I just realized something. When they come out with iOS, the next iOS, where are we going to get the Chrome from?
It's going to be from Facebook. It's all going to be blue.
What are we going to do?
It's just going to be a PSD with a bunch of like buttons. That's it.
Yeah, it's really crazy, you know, having gone to a couple of the owner camps, you know, hearing all the different stories of success or struggles, and in a lot of cases hearing a lot of owners like trying to figure out like when to kill the baby, you know.
Yep.
Which is another podcast Good episode Lord. Topic we have, you know, coming up with Kirill from Scoutsy, you know, talking yeah. about, you know, intentionally ending something.
Yep.
Yeah. I was in your panel and someone
at Owner Summit.
Yeah, yeah. At Owner Summit, Jay Finelli said I'll try to paraphrase. He said, like, let's just face it, there, you know, a significant amount of us in this room, like our companies just aren't going to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's,
you know. Well, and that's the truth. I mean, few companies get past their first year, let alone their first 5 years. Then you have economic milestones like getting up to $1 million in revenue. That's a huge milestone for a small business. Getting up to $5 million, even bigger, you know, where it's something like less than 3% of small businesses started in the U.S. ever make it to $10 million in annual revenue. Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah, it's not easy. I think a lot of people make it look easy or even make it look enviable. But as you know, Anthony, once you start a business, you know, you can kind of say goodbye to sleep, especially in those first couple of years. It's just no matter what you do, unless you're going the Michael Jackson route, you're not going to sleep well just because of the stress that comes from running that. And then eventually as you get bigger, you find yourself doing less and less of the things that got you to where you were in the first place to start the business. You're not designing, you're managing payroll, you're, you know, dealing with clients all the time, you're in meetings constantly, and you're just not doing what it is you love to do.
What is the Michael Jackson route?
Well, that's
Michael. I want to go the Michael Jackson.
Well, that's where Michael Jackson, what he was getting drugs every night from a doctor. That's how he died. Is he OD'd on the?
Oh yeah, just like you've reached the maximum, you know, like human. You now need, you know.
Yeah, we now have to put Michael Jackson. You out medically. Put you out.
Gotcha.
So, Greg, I have a question that might tie some of this together for our listeners. You know, designers or developers out there. If the landscape is changing, right, we know there's going to be work, but, you know, we may not make as much money doing it. We're going to have lots of more competition, especially in the individual to four to 10 person size shops. Mm. What is that going to do to our salaries? You know, because I think for a while, you know, designers have been really happy that over the years we've finally been able to make really good incomes, right? And we've said, okay, now, you know, design is appreciated, like people value us, and then we do this cool stuff. And then from the agency perspective, like, what is an agency owner, how is an agency owner going to manage that, you know? At, you know, does that mean a constant rotation of employees, and once they reach a certain financial ceiling, they have to go to work somewhere else? Or I mean, that's the scary part for me.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it could, right? So it could literally be where, and we've even had this though, you know, there are limits to where you can take people, and not only just in payroll, but even just in career advancement. And so I think that there's definitely, there's limitations to how long someone could actually stay on a team before they need to make another move. Now, if that's monetary, monetary level, I don't know, but I mean, that's, you got to do what you got to do. You know, the business still has to run. Once you start not sticking to whatever those principles or that plan, that's when you run the risk of losing the company, right? You just start bleeding money. So, I think the good news in all this though, is that despite this one singular report, you know, it would be nice if our industry had like three or four of these things, you know, where Gartner was doing one, Forrester was doing one, maybe like Smashing Magazine. I don't know why they're not doing some kind of industry reporting on this kind of stuff. But I think it just means not so much everybody necessarily may make less. I think it'll likely be if you're a freelancer, you're not going to be able to charge as much as you do now. And if you're a larger company, you probably need to reduce your rates, but you'll still be doing pretty good.
Yeah.
There you have it.
There's a lot to think about.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, yeah, while we all kind of chew on that, I think we're about out of time here. Greg, what should people do if they want to, you know, continue to hear your thoughts and your antics?
Subscribe to my newsletter. I can be found at on Twitter at Brilliant Crank. Mm-hmm. My website, airbagindustries.com. And from there you can get to Medium and all current kinds of places, you know, where I'm posting things. But for now, that's kind of where I can be found and where I'll be sharing some of these thoughts. So in talking with Anthony, and kind of prepping for that presentation that I did yesterday, I'm slowly working up to something I think I'll get posted on Medium, and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah. I can't wait to see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds interesting. Yeah. Be looking forward to it, man. Thanks very much again for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Thanks.
Guys, please check out the feed from this podcast on iTunes and give us a subscriber rating if you so choose. Thanks very much. Bye. Love you. Bye. Today's episode is brought to you by Pingboard, an employee directory that will supercharge your team. Today's best companies use Pingboard to help their growing team continue to feel small. The Pingboard company directory lets your team learn about each other in a way that's fun and engaging and ensures that they'll always have important info about their team wherever they are. With Pingboard, you have one place to organize everything about your team, from private employee data to shared photos, contact info, and fun facts. Now with the Pingboard Vacation Calendar, your team will always know when someone's out. With a few taps of the Pingboard mobile app, anyone can share that they're working remote, sick, or that they'll be in Belize scuba diving next month. Show your team how much you love them by trying Pingboard out for free at pingboard.com.